Hello, and welcome back to another episode on The Daily Friend. My name is Anne Lukiewa, and I'm standing in for our colleague Nicholas Lorimer today. So in his absence, I'm joined by IRR CEO, John Endres. John, how are you?
How's it, Andrew? Hello, viewers. Good to be on the show again.
Lovely to have you on. And we are also joined by our colleague, Chris Patterson. Chris, you are also in Cape Town. Are you just as hot as I am?
Yes, I am. It's very good to be back, actually.
It's lovely to have you. Why?
Because I haven't been on the show since June last year, actually.
Yay, that's so yeah. Well, we are very, very happy to have you back on. So let's get into our first story of the day. And this story is about the sonar that we recently had. So what usually happens is after the sonar speech, the MPs go to Parliament and they have an opportunity to comment in the form of a speech. So they rebuttal the sonar, if you will. And if you did not watch these, it was 2 days. It was quite a long and drawn out process of watching each person go to the front and give their speech and so forth and so forth. But what you missed is that MK essentially continues that the elections were rigged. Every single MK speech included that. The DA ministers in cabinet, they essentially praised their work thus far. And they said that they support the reforms that the president introduced. And then perhaps the speech that I was most impressed with, which I quite liked, and this is only because it came across very natural, and there was only one golden thread through the entire speech, was that of Western Cape Premier Alan Windey. And basically, he spoke about the military presence, which was announced in the SONA speech that will now be coming to the Western Cape and the Gauteng, but obviously Western Cape now. And he essentially said that instead of spending so much of the budget on the protecting the public officials, let's spend the money on actually protecting the public. And let's get resources in the hands of our detectives who in some areas share computers, like 60 of them share one computer. It was absolutely absurd. So, okay, the president listened and he then responded. This happened yesterday and Business Day reported on his response. I'll read a little bit from the article. President Cyril Ramaphosa used his reply to the debate on the State of the Nation address to defend his administration's reform program, outlining further institutional interventions and caution coalition partners against claiming individual credit for collective work. Addressing Parliament, the president framed his response around the theme of building, describing South Africa as a nation of builders that does not run away from problems. He urged South Africans to build like beavers, arguing that real progress requires coordination, consistency, and a shared purpose. So let's build like beavers with urgency, with unity, and with the quiet determination to make something strong enough to hold, something that lasts and something that shelters more than just ourselves. So he then continued to talk about the various indicators that has improved or that have improved. He said that though they seem abstract, they have a real influence on our lives. And he mentioned ending load shedding, improving the rail and the port performance. He mentioned the performance of the presidential employment stimulus. And then he made this wonderful renewed call for BEE. He said that now is the time now is not the time to abandon BEE. Now is the time to make it more effective. Now, I'm very interested in hearing what you both make of this, this call for South Africans to build like beavers. I'll admit that I'm slightly frustrated by the underlying tone, at least. To me, it feels it's a tone of making it our fault that we've not yet built like beavers. So, John, I'll maybe start with you. Am I being overly sensitive? Is he actually just trying to present a unifying message to a nation that are essentially looking towards, they're looking for direction and looking for some sign of credibility in the year that lies ahead? Am I approaching this with a little bit too much pessimism, or what did you make of his response?
Yeah, I think, you know, the president is looking for messaging that will persuade voters to give the ANC their vote again, in the local government elections later in the year, probably. And in the Sona address originally, I thought there was a certain frantic tone to his presentation. So he displayed energy levels that were a lot higher than in previous Sonas. And the reason for that, I think, is that he realizes that support for the ANC is declining. He needs to do something about that, as does the entire party. And so what do you do? Well, you sell your achievements as much as possible, and you minimize your failures as much as possible, and you announce grandiose plans and visions for the future in order to get the voters to endorse your party. And I think, you know, that was basically the message that came out of this. It was repeated throughout the Sona debate as well. If one was to give the president some credit, I think it would be for at least now talking about economic growth and giving that a bit more attention than he has in the past. I think in the Sona address itself, he mentioned it 25 times. So that's not bad. You know, it seems to be important. And of course, for us at the IRR, it's a very important topic. You know, we think economic growth is absolutely what is indispensable to improve the situation in South Africa. So to see the president mentioning it is good. However, we also think that a lot of the measures that the government is pursuing at the moment are the measures that are comfortable. In other words, if you can spend lots of money to get economic growth, that's the best way, because who wouldn't want to spend money? But there are some tough measures that are also needed to get the economy growing. And those are things like protecting property rights by, for example, having another look at expropriation without compensation and reviewing that damaging piece of legislation, Expropriation Act. Looking at race-based laws and overall ending cadre deployment and elevating performance and merit in the public service. Those are the kinds of things that need to happen. I think we're seeing a little bit of a grudging movement towards that, but still very much a rearguard action from the president and also from the rest of cabinet. They're not moving wholeheartedly in the direction of very high growth as we would like to see them doing. Anlu.
Yeah, I think you make a very good point. It is wonderful to see that there is now more mention of economic growth. And we discussed yesterday on the show, I've been on the show this week twice, sorry for the viewers who've seen me twice this week. But yesterday on the show, we actually discussed how the headlines are feeding through in public perspectives of what is happening in the political and the economic environment. And it is genuinely nice to, even though it doesn't really, we don't really see it feed through yet, but to just see things like economic growth taking headlines and even criticism of BEE taking headlines. Chris, one of the things that the president mentioned actually to this exact point is that he said he knows that many of these reforms feel abstract, but that they do feed through to our everyday experience. So he listed a couple of things that's been getting better, like ending load shedding and the rail performance. But just jumping off your everyday experience, do you actually feel like the foundation is getting stronger for us average South Africans? Or do you think there's still a big disconnect between what politicians speak about in these debates and what is actually happening on the ground?
Yeah, I think so. Because, I mean, the president's been talking reform for 6 years, and in every Sona speech and every Sona debate, somewhere the word reform is mentioned and South Africans aren't seeing action. And if, I mean, I didn't even actually watch this owner, to be honest. I thought there was a better use of my time. But yeah, I don't think South Africans believe politicians. When politicians open their mouths, I think the automatic assumption is that they're going to lie and try to cover their bases. But I mean, there was the use of beavers. I think the president has an excellent speechwriter, to be honest. But I think I also think that there could have been a better animal to use. I mean, beavers, we know, bold, but South Africans are the ones that's bolding their communities to try and state-proof themselves away from the state, and that's what needs to be sort of expanded upon. Use that public-private partnerships to actually build. And I think the president also said that South Africans shouldn't run away from it, from their problems. It's the ANC that's been running away from their problems. It's South Africans are actually, every day South Africans are getting down and doing and getting busy.
Yeah, so that's an excellent point. South Africans are genuinely not running away. We have no alternative than to stay, and we want to build. So it's genuinely a case of South Africans wanting to build. The environment is here. We've also, in some of our pre-discussions, we mentioned that South Africa is such a good place in the world, like globally, for businesses to start. We have the resources, we have labor. We are the spot that people want to be. But if we don't build the policy environment that actually facilitates this building like beavers, then you can't expect people to build like beavers. But yeah, I think you make a good point, Chris, that there's a bit of a definition difference sometimes between what South Africans consider reform to be and what reform really means in these speeches, particularly when the president gives them.
Andrew, which is, we're seeing a bit of disconnect, I think, between the president's speech and reality out there, which some of our viewers are reflecting in the comments, and just saying, we're not seeing many of the great achievements that the president announced. I guess we could say, at least load shedding seems to have been more or less ended for now. That's an achievement, even though it's really just doing the basics, which is to deliver electricity when that's your job. But the economy is still growing very slowly. Unemployment is very high. Many people are without jobs. And it doesn't seem that the government is really focused on addressing that very quickly. So I think that's a fair criticism from our viewers.
Yeah. Well, looking at the comments, I also see here they did transform themselves a higher salary recently. And that is quite on point with our second story. So good on spotting that one. So this brings us to the Tshwane staff situation. Let's maybe start off with a quick summary of the situation. So back in 2021, there was a national collective agreement that said municipal workers should get a 3.5% increase on their wages. And the city of Tshwane then applied for exemptions. And at that stage, they had a 4 billion rand deficit. So they said, please don't let us pay this. And then in 2022, the South African Local Government Bargaining Council, they rejected the city's exemption application. And the city then said, okay, but then we're going to have to start this long legal battle to actually avoid having to pay this because we can't pay it. Then in 2023, a year later, a three-month violent unprotected strike essentially broke out. And the city, which was then under Mayor Celia Brink, they dismissed many workers. The city also then applied for an exemption of a new 5.5% increase. So in 2024, the Labour Court then granted the city's exemption application for that 5.4% increase from 2023. But they said that initial 2021 3.5% increase, that needs to go back to the South African Local Government Bargaining Council. They still need to decide on whether that needs to be paid or not. And then in October last year, the Business Council, they definitively ordered the city of Tshwane to pay that 3.5% back pay in the next 6 months. So by now, it was under the new administration, because in September 2024, obviously, if you remember, Mayor Celia Brink was ousted. And now we had, in this new administration, it was under Mayor Nasipi Moya. So they then decided, no, they will not be appealing it. They'll rather accept it, and they'll go to the bargaining council. They'll go and speak with the unions and actually see if they can reach a compromise on what to pay. And we are now at yesterday, when an agreement was actually, a deal was signed, and the city of Tshwane is now responsible to back pay the employees just over 1 billion rand. Now, this is a little bit less than the 1.5 billion that they were supposed to pay, but it is still 1 billion rand that needs to go out in the next 3 years. So MoneyWeb reported on this. I'll just read a little bit from the article. Tshwane Mayor Nasipi Moya emphasized at a media briefing on Thursday, this is now yesterday, that settling this dispute was a top priority for her administration from the day it assumed the city government following a motion of no confidence in Brink in September 2024. Moya said, a city needs a motivated workforce to implement its plans and campaigns. To ensure this, the mayoral committee decided at that stage that it wouldn't litigate to apply for exemptions from wage agreements. When the bargaining council's ruling came in October last year, the administration therefore accepted the liability and entered into negotiations with the unions, which led to this settlement. The total back pay was reduced after the unions agreed that the 3.5% increase would only be applied to workers' basic salaries. Moya gave the assurance that the settlement has been provided for in the city's adjustment budget, which is currently before council. To be clear, she said, the budget remains fully funded with an operating surplus of 1.2 trillion rand. Moya said the first phase of implementation will be covered as departments have identified targeted reductions in non-strategic and discretionary expenditure. And then she went on to say that there's additional funding for energy and electricity and for water and sanitation. And there's a further 15 million that's allocated towards emergency water supply capacity. And so she goes on. So then as part of this article and this point, there's also an ongoing negotiations to reinstate 43 workers who were dismissed when these unprotected strikes broke out. And then, of course, we have previous Mayor Sylvia Brink, who made comments on this, and he said that this matter could have been taken to review to the Labour Court, as the DA did back in 2023. We put residents first and won that case, ensuring that billions went towards service delivery. But the ANC-led coalition squandered this precedent. They made unaffordable promises to union bosses at residents' expense. Mm-hmm. Okay, so John, I think it's important for us to maybe consider the story in, like, we're going into local government elections. And at least as I see it, the story kind of sets up a situation where there can potentially be a major political clash between these two competing priorities. We now have water and we have wages. And so former Mayor Sylvia Brink, he argues that handing over R1 billion to the unions completely kneecaps the city's ability to actually fix infrastructure. And on the flip side, we actually have Mayor Nasipi Moya insisting that they can't run a city without happy employees. So my question, I suppose, is when we go to the polls, which one of these two do you think will actually carry the most weight? Do you think they can potentially be like a standoff between the DA looking for water and the ANC looking for wages? Or how do you see this play out?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of quite a complicated story. You know, so if you're trying to follow the 3.5 there and the 5.5 there and the billions this way and the billions that way, it's quite tricky. But I think maybe the way to look at this is to look at it in terms of operating expenditure versus capital expenditure. So OPEX versus CAPEX. And this is a big topic in South Africa as a whole, not just in Swane. Because one number that we keep going on about is something called gross fixed capital formation, which is like as a share of the size of the total economy, how much money gets spent on roads and factories and machines and those sorts of things versus what gets spent on operating whatever you've got. And in South Africa, that number is very low. It's 15% of GDP. The global average is 26%. And emerging markets are often over 30%. So if we look at the numbers here for Tswane, their budget for this year, I think, is about 50 billion rand. Their capex budget is about 2.5 billion. So they're at about 5% capex is about 5% of the total. And given that not enough money has been spent on maintenance and infrastructure for many years now, maybe decades, that is far too low. And so if you're giving wage increases to staff, I think that eats into your ability to spend money on CapEx, which is actually where the money needs to go. It needs to go to the water pipes, the sewerage pipes, street lights, electricity transformer boxes, and all those sorts of things. And that for me is the big picture here, which is that the city there has decided to increase its OPEX. That's going to come eventually at the expense of its CapEx. And it means that more services are going to break down for Tswana residents, as they're already doing for, you know, Johannesburg residents and across many other cities in Johannesburg, in South Africa as well. That for me is the big point here. I think in that sense, probably Celia Brink is right, that this is a choice for present satisfaction over future benefit, avoiding a conflict today, making the workers happy today, but going to pay the price for that tomorrow. That's the problem. Andrew.
Yeah. Well, I genuinely hope that it is seen that way going into the local government elections. Chris, I want to also get your thoughts on it. There's one specific detail that caught my attention here, and that's that 43 municipal workers that they want to reinstate. So to me, at least, this dynamic feels a little bit like the parent trying to discipline the child, and then the, let's say, maybe the step-parent or the other second parent comes in and they just let the kid get away with it. And then the first parent only looks bad. Do you worry that this kind of reinstating them gives the idea that there's no long-term consequence for destructive behavior? It was quite a violent protest, and Celia took quite a strong stand. What's your take on it?
Oh, absolutely. I think that the unions have always held municipalities hostage, and I think the ANC is to blame for that. The ANC gives in, just like you say, the parent gives in. And, I mean, there's absolutely no concern for the ratepayer whatsoever. They're just going to have to pay that extra $1.5 billion, or just under $1.5 billion, and they're just not going to get any better services. With the streetlights still not going to work, they're still going to go without water. And, I mean, it's not only specific to Tswane. There's, I think, according to National Treasury's local government database, there's about 168 municipalities in financial distress. That's due to low rate spaces for people that don't have jobs, that where the economy is not growing. So if you can't even invest money into infrastructure to get investment, to build skills and to create jobs, then you're not going to get anywhere.
Yeah. No, I think that's an excellent point. Perhaps as a last mention from my side, I just want to, there's like this negative reinforcement cycle that stick or bite or whatever that is called in English, that you can start seeing it form in the sense that it's at the expense of the many, a few is now receiving higher salaries, and not even immediately, it's like over a long-term cycle over the next 3 years. And instead, what could have happened is there could have been a situation where services are actually, money is being pushed in, as John mentioned, into CapEx, and you actually have better service delivery, and you don't have schools and businesses having to close because there's no water. In fact, that would have created more jobs and more stable jobs and introduced more money flowing into the economy, and that could have then eventually led to higher salaries. But that has now been put stop because of the immediate need to increase salaries now. Okay, great. Let's move on to the third story, the final one. Apologies for rushing off that one. We have a third story as usual. And this brings us to gambling students. Okay, so NSFAS, it's been reported that NSFAS students are gambling their allowances. So money intended for rent and food and their textbooks and their living expenses, it's now being gambled instead. And this has led NSFAS and the National Gambling Body to launch a coordinated initiative to curb gambling among students, particularly on illegal online platforms that target young people. So IOL reports, and I'm just going to read this, in a joint statement, the institutions highlighted growing exposure of youth to online betting, especially on unregulated platforms. Research shows that aggressive digital advertising, promotional offers, and the convenience of mobile access have fueled increased gambling among students. At the center of the intervention is the protection of public education funds. NSFAS acting CEO Wasim Karim cautioned that using study allowances for gambling jeopardizes students' long-term prospects. He stressed that NSFAS funding is meant to support academic journeys and essential living costs. Diverting these funds to gambling, he said, undermines both educational outcomes and long-term financial well-being. The campaign will focus on prevention, awareness, and informed decision-making. So what they'll now do is the joint campaign will roll out nationwide outreach programs, campus workshops, and financial literacy drives. Early intervention initiatives will also be introduced to identify and support at-risk students. The intervention comes amid intensifying political pressures over what critics describe as a worsening gambling crisis in South Africa. Rise and Zanzi has accused the Department of Trade, Industry and Competition, the DTIC, which oversees gambling legislation, of failing to respond decisively to what the party calls a 1 trillion rand gambling crisis affecting households nationwide. John, I don't know quite what to make of the story, I must admit. I think it's important to look at the broader economic and regulatory angle here. Rise and Zanzi is putting this pressure on the DTIC, kind of accusing them of failing to respond to it, and calling for, I know that they've made some submissions as well, but they're calling for tighter legislation to actually stop people from betting. I wonder how you read the situation, because if adults are freely choosing to spend their money on betting apps, is that actually a crisis of the government needing to regulate more? Or is there like a hidden economic story that we can read into here in terms of just people wanting to, they're acting out of desperacy and wanting to make more with what they have? What do you make of the story?
I think when it comes to the motivations, desperation may come into it for some of the students. And I know that we've covered previous stories where this also seems to be an issue for people receiving welfare grants. So, you know, grant money from the state being gambled. And partly I think it is people expecting to turn a small amount of money into a big amount of money that will change their lives. And of course, that hope is a very strong motivator to gamble. What is unclear, I think, to the people gambling is how unlikely that is to happen. And that, as a matter of fact, it is better to see this as spending money without a return. So effectively, that's what you're doing. Another aspect that comes into it here is that this is donated money or money given by the state that comes from other people. And that is for a specific purpose. In the case of welfare grants, to alleviate poverty and alleviate suffering. In the case of NSFAS, to enable tertiary education and to give people a better prospect in life. And I think for such funds, which are actually dedicated to a specific purpose, to be misused for a different purpose is a breaking of the contract in a way. We say, no, we're trying to help you, but if you're going to be gambling the money, which effectively in most cases means throwing the money away, you know, you can throw it into the sea or set fire to it with much the same effect, then that is not a good use of that money. So that's the one side of it. I don't think this gambling is very good. I think that's a very bad development for the country. The other side is, what do you do about it? And we see now a few of these authorities trying to have interventions in terms of education and informing people about what you should and what you shouldn't do with your allowance and the implications of gambling. Hopefully that works. Another approach is banning or regulating, which is also going to be tough, you know, because these are online platforms. You know, the servers can be hosted anywhere in the world. How do you regulate them? How do you ban them? So it's a tricky task for the government. I think the need is there to do something about it. I don't think it should be left unregulated. And I say that even though, you know, I do believe in free markets and letting people get on with their lives. But if you're doing it with somebody else's money and you're already in dire straits, it's not the best use of your money. And it's probably better if you don't do it.
Yeah, I love how you said, we're hoping it works. That is quite the way to go forward. Yeah. Hoping it works. Yeah. But no, I agree. I think it's a classic dilemma. Like, the state is essentially handing cash out to young adults, and it's supposed to cover their basic living costs. And now they're shocked to find out that a portion of that's like being gambled. You're kind of giving young people money, tax money. Yes, you're right to point that out. You're giving them money and expecting them to spend it in the right way. I don't know how to address it really.
Also consider like the problem it causes down the line. You know, so you're going to have, you know, these kids without a degree, without food. Then turning in desperation maybe to the university management or to the state and saying, we haven't got money, we're hungry. So what must happen then? You know, they've already been supported. So it is very tricky.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. And it creates, well, I'll get to that in a moment. Chris, I from an everyday observational level, like if you have to, and I'm asking you a very vulnerable question here, if you have to put yourself in the same situation, do you genuinely think that, let's call it what it is, a government-run, NSFAS, government-run workshop is going to stop a 20-year-old from placing a bet on a weekend on
not
a soccer match?
Not
I don't know if that's going to work.
No.
Do you think that, John explained this situation of almost you're breaking the contract if you don't spend it on the way yeah. that it's intended to be spent. What do you make of the situation?
I think I know I'm that age, I'm university age. You know, I can trust myself, but I can't trust the government to trust a whole bunch of young people. So I think if the government needs to create an opportunity where they close off that opportunity, where people see that opportunity in gambling by, again, going back to growth and then boosting skills. Building skills, keeping the people busy. I mean, for example, if you look at small children that don't go to school, there's soccer clubs and things like that. If you can get them into programs like that, that keeps them busy. But I don't think talking to them will help one bit.
Yeah. No, I think it's a wonderful idea to have literacy workshops. I think I would have probably had one hell of an investment by now if I had a literacy workshop when I was 18 or 19 years old. But I genuinely don't think that that's going to solve the problem. I think addressing the issue of getting that sense of desperacy, like I saw one of the comments is just one more spin. And it's so it's so accurate because it creates this whole cycle where you're putting your money, your allowance on a bet and you're hoping to make one big win and then you're losing it. And now you have to make double the big win. So just one more spin. And at the end of the day, you're stuck in the cycle that John also explained, where now you have to again look to the government and say, please help. Please help. John, any last comment from you?
Yeah, just following up on what Chris was saying. So I think you're quite right, Chris. So I think for many people, the gambling is an expression of not being able to visualize a long-term plan that leads to success for you or your family. Right? And you try to think about the future 5 years from now. And what we like to see is, you know, people saying, okay, if I study, I keep my head down, get a good degree, after 3 or 4 years, enter the labor market, find a job, gain experience, see my income increase over time. That's like a plan that can work. But I think many South Africans don't see that plan because they see, you know, 40% unemployment. They see high dropout rates out of the university and they say, look, you know, I'm sort of doing this, going through the motions, but this is probably not going to work. This is not an economy that's growing. That's not going to, you know, create a great life for me. So I might as well, you know, gamble it because, you know, what's the point? And for that to change, the thing that Chris was saying needs to happen. You know, you need to have a growing economy where a person can look at it and say, okay, I can see this economy is growing at 7% per year. I can see demand for labor out of business increasing year on year. I can see incomes rising, and I've got a place in that. And because I can see a place for myself in that future, I don't need to take this chance, you know, on gambling away the little bit of money that I do have. So these two things go hand in hand. The banning and educating is one side of it. But creating an alternative, attractive option is actually really, really important.
Yeah. And in conclusion, I think it connects wonderfully back to our Sona story in the sense that this, if you are wondering what the public thinks of the president's Sona address, this is what they think. They think that it is not inspiring enough to, instead of gambling, to keep that money, that they have
inspiring
enough
and convincing enough, right? Like exactly. you don't believe it. And you're like, you know, exactly. It sounds very nice, but I don't actually believe you. Yeah.
I don't genuinely believe it.
Yeah.
Okay. That is great. That is all from us. Thank you so much for joining us on this Friday afternoon and enjoy your weekend. See you next week.
Thanks. Bye-bye.